Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, welcome to one of our fireside chats. It's wonderful to see you again. Some faces that are becoming very familiar in this space, which is really, really great to see. And a particularly warm welcome to our guest tonight, Ilanit Gerson. Ilanit is an educational psychologist currently working in private practice. Her focus is on anxiety and oppositional behaviors in children, as well as concurrently empowering their parents with practical skills. That's very encouraging, isn't it? One of her fields of expertise is in understanding neurodiversity, particularly high-functioning autism. And I think we're seeing more and more and more of that in the educational space, so I'm particularly interested in hearing what Ilanit has to say there. Ilanit runs social skills groups for children to enhance the negotiation of their social worlds. We need to have a good conversation about that one. She is well known in the educational world, having worked in a wide range of schools for over 20 years. She holds a BCom in information technology from the University of Johannesburg and postgraduate degrees in education, educational psychology, and learning support from the University of Johannesburg and Yeshiva University, New York. Ilanit, very warm welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So this topic is very front. Okay, give her a clap then. This is a very front of mind topic for schools at the moment. And it seems to have become more front of mind than ever before since COVID. At our SAHESA meeting on Monday, we were talking to some of the heads, and I said to one of the heads, to me it feels like leadership in a school pre-COVID is a completely different ballgame to leadership in a school post-COVID. And a large part of that is the anxiety levels that have skyrocketed since the COVID era of the isolation, teaching at home, working at home. We called it schooling from home because we ran our full curriculum. But it's a different landscape. We are in a completely different landscape. And I think that because it's new, so many of us don't have a model to work from, whether it's in the classroom or at home. We are struggling with a model to work from. So the work that you do is really, really of interest to us, and we really are interested to hear what you have to say. So let's get into the questions and hand over to you. I was looking at your slides. Do you want to just spend a minute talking to us about the stresses that these teenagers face? Because let's be honest, they are very different to the stresses that we had when we were teenagers.
Yes, I think that's a great start. I fully agree, just going back to what you're saying about education changing with COVID. I actually stopped working in schools in the middle of COVID. Most of the schools I was in, I just finished like my fourth or fifth degree, and my job was to stand outside the bathrooms and sanitize all the children's hands for hours and hours. And then you would see everyone with their masks. And I really think for us, education shifted then. And I went after that specifically into anxiety, because such a way of thinking of it is that there's this understanding that anxiety is usually the parents' fault. The parents, if you were just a little bit less anxious, your child would be fine. You know, oh, it's the mommy. If she would just not be so coddling, that idea. And also with a lack of an understanding of how our teenagers have changed, and because of, so going back, first of all, COVID brought a level of awareness of death into the world that our children hadn't had before. Research shows that from the age before, the age of about 8 or 9 is where children understood death as permanence. And up till then, there was magical thinking. And from COVID, that age has changed to 4 or 5, which means that children are understanding things that they shouldn't understand developmentally, and that causes confusion. Confusion causes anxiety. There are two times when I hear in therapy, I'm so confused, and that is if the child is very high functioning on the spectrum, or if the child is very anxious. And they start to say, I can't understand the world, it's very confusing. And that's really the starting point of understanding anxiety, is why is somebody finding the world so confusing, and why are they struggling to believe in themselves and their ability to maneuver or manage the world? And really, I do believe COVID was a turning point in that. there also is for parents and for teenagers a huge shift in how we see the world. South African politics is a big part of it. We all don't often speak so positively at home or at our tables or things like that. We try and be very positive, but there are things that happen in the news or corruption things or things that we spill over as parents or adults with our worries onto our children. And teenagers are much more black and white with thinking, and they will take things to, we nuanced as adults, but teenagers will often hear worries, politics, corruption, the potholes in the road, whatever it is that's bothering their families, and take it on to quite an extreme level. I would never, I would always. That's developmentally appropriate for teenagers. There also is a lot of uncertainty over our future. We always thought medicine and science would solve everything until COVID, and it really has flipped the world. Do we vaccinate? Don't we vaccinate? So many big changes where up until now we thought science had all the answers, and suddenly we're not so sure. You know, we always knew science, now we're looking at these alternatives that we never thought we would take seriously, and suddenly they are more serious. We have to also know that our world has become smaller and smaller. Just this week I've dealt with a 26-year-old girl who committed suicide. And what was so amazing is she was a teacher of teenagers, and these teenagers who I was debriefing had had so much exposure to death. When I think of myself at 15, I knew two people who had died tragically. You know, it wasn't a thing, but they were just naming and listing, and you know, they also thought 25 was very old. They didn't think it was such a tragedy, because that's the beauty of being 15. Yeah, but the whole world has become so much smaller. We're exposed to so much. We switch on our phones, the videos we see. I don't think we even realize the level of exposure of what our children and our teenagers are exposed to. We need to understand what actually, just to go backwards on something which I'm quite strong about, is what is the point of guidelines for ages? You know, like with us in the olden days, you would sneak into a 16 movie or an 18 movie. Now we're buying our kids games that say 18 or 21, and we're like, nah, it's fine. What could be so bad? They'll see a bit of shooting. You know, that's kind of the point of guidelines. Is developmentally, our brain is made to be able to focus and cope with different things at different stages. And when our brain is exposed to something that developmentally we're not ready to see, it actually causes a trauma. We're seeing that as an example with children who've been exposed to porn, where they act as if they've been sexually abused, and they haven't, and everything is fine, but all of those symptoms come out. And what we're starting to realize is their brains get stuck on an image that developmentally they were not yet able to understand. And that causes a halt in their thinking, and that's why you often see kids fixating on things that they don't understand. What I think we all don't realize is TikTok, Instagram, all the things our kids just naturally get, together with the Google bubble and the way we start, what you look at, you see more of. I don't think we often realize that our kids are being exposed to things that they think they understand, but they don't always understand, and that is actually going to transform their thinking. And we know that when children are stressed, or any of us are stressed, think of yourselves when you've had a very bad day, you're not open to learning and seeing different points of views and calming down. So I think all of that just makes a very hard environment that our teenagers are growing up in, and for us to parent in these new ways. I can't keep up. My first degree was a mistake. It was a BCom in computer programming. But that means I'm au fait with technology, and I cannot keep up with what my teenagers are on. I hear new things all the time, and I used to try to think I'm a cool mom and I know what's happening. I don't even pretend. Now my kids know I'm a dinosaur. I don't understand anything. But we can't even keep up with them. So for parents, we're trying so hard to give our children this perfect bubble and upbringing, and we want everything individualized, and we want to give them a sense of self and a good start into an adult world that we know is so hard, and we don't even understand fully what they're exposed to. So it creates huge pressures on us, as well as huge pressures on our children, where we can't control anymore as much as we used to be able to.
And I suppose the landscape is much wider as well, because in our day, bullying, for example, at school, stayed at school, essentially.
Yes.
Whereas now, there's going to be a child on the playground filming that, and before you know it, that video has gone viral.
Yes.
So their world is that landscape is different, and we as parents don't know how to navigate. We didn't have phones. So we don't know what good parenting behavior or adulting behavior is in that space.
Exactly. And we collude at times. When my child was shouted at by his teacher and he goes to the bathroom and phones me, I've already phoned the principal and got that teacher disciplined before the teacher's finished the lesson. And possibly I'm not helping my child learn to tolerate distress and manage his own life. So we're also seeing that other spin-off where maybe we're overly helicoptering in a way we could care now because we're so connected.
That's an entire rabbit hole right there, isn't it?
Yeah, and we think we're helping. That's also.
But I think we might come back to that point a little later because tonight's talk is specifically about parenting the anxious generation. So we want to be able to give parents actionable tips. That's the point of this. We don't want you just going home with the theory. We talk the theory. And I think personally, one of my opinions is that where we are lacking in the industry of helping our teenagers and our children is that we've become very good with the terminologies and the languages, and it sounds very fancy to have the conversation, but there's not enough provision of tools, actionable things to do when we are trying to navigate such a complex environment.
And that's exactly what I like, is I believe from the years and years I've been doing this, I have found quite specific skills that are actually very manageable and doable, but parents have to want to do them.
Sure. Like anything else, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's take this a step further. We are getting an understanding of the stresses that our children and teenagers face. We understand that we are not necessarily naturally equipped to assist them. We know that they don't automatically have the vocabulary necessarily to express how they are managing or how this anxiety is manifesting for them. So what are the typical behaviors we would see that indicate to us as the adults that this particular youngster is struggling with anxiety? What do we see? What are the behaviors?
The first behavior that I'll always find is when I say to the parents, who's in control at your home? The most anxious child controls the home, and that's from age 2 till 20. The anxious child moods are strong. They have strong reactions and big reactions to everything, and the family tiptoes around that child. And obviously, it's difficult when the child's 4 or 5, but when they're 15 or 16, it's really difficult when the family is controlled by them. So the first thing I will always ask parents in an intake and figure that out is, who are you walking on eggshells around in your family? And that means that's the anxious child. There's different things that we can pick up. So one of the main symptoms I would start looking at is who controls the family, which I want to go into with parenting skills. What schools are going to see, or teachers, or at home, is a child who's very irritable and grumpy. Nothing you can do is right. They are very rigid. They have decided a plan for their day. So if you fetch them from school and you want to do a detour, you can have a meltdown like you actually can't believe because they had a plan to go home and whatever it is. They often held themselves together the whole day at school with having planned exactly how things would go. At school, when PT is changed or when the science teacher is sick, they can completely flip and just not be able to manage themselves because things have changed. They very, very tired. So tired that you actually start thinking you've got a very lazy child because they use so much energy worrying. The way I often explain that exhaustion and irritability is we all wake up with this much energy in the day. And when somebody is anxious, they are spiraling in their mind all the time with every single worry. So imagine, for example, you're all out now and you told your child you're going to be home at 7:30 and we go on till 9 o'clock and you kept home happily at 9 o'clock. Your child's been looking where your car is, they 360 us, not us them, which is possibly a problem, but anyway. They've already thought of every possible thing. Anxious children will tell me, I've pictured my parents dying, I've pictured how I'm going to get the news, I've pictured the funeral, I've pictured where I'm going to live. And then you walk in quite happily and say, hi, I'm home, why aren't you in bed? And this child has this huge reaction. That's how they are living all the time, when you're 5 minutes late, when you're 10 minutes late, when you don't go according to their plans. So the first thing to always look out for is edgy, restless, quite intolerant and aggressive and trying to control you a lot, which I want to speak about the controlling in a minute. They also have disturbed sleep. They often can't fall asleep. Younger children will avoid going to sleep at any cost at all, because all of us know the minute you actually switch off your phone and lie down is when the day comes through your head. If you're anxious, you're not just processing your day, you're thinking of every possible thing that can go wrong tomorrow and every possible thing that's gone wrong now. Anxious children will do anything to avoid bedtime. They are the ones who ask you, as you're putting them to sleep and you've been lying for them for an hour and you're finally leaving them, they'll ask a question like, how do I know you're not going to die? Or is there a God? Or do you hate me? Why do you love him more than you love me? They'll ask triggering questions that they know you will react to so that you'll stay with them for longer. Bedtime is never a good time to chat, but anxious children will do that. Anxious children, you also always feel are crying wolf. They genuinely have a sore stomach when they wake up in the morning. They really have a sore throat. They have a headache. They get so anxious. You never know if you should believe them or not. You start to make rules like, unless you vomit at school, you're going to be at school until you vomit there in the classroom. And then you feel terrible because that's the day that they do vomit at school and everyone's looking at you like you're the worst parent ever. But those are the things. There's one other big sign of an anxious child, and that is that anxious children are very manipulative. The reason, and we don't want to say that, in schools when we give feedback to parents, we don't want to say, look, your child's just actually a manipulative brat. You know, he just wants everything his way. Because we will get into trouble if we say that. But often anxious children come across like that because they don't think they can manage in the world. Anxiety means, I'm stopping here and I'm not sure. I know something bad is going to happen. I just don't know what it is. Am I going to crash on my way home? Am I going to, every possible bad thing I've already thought of. Anxious people think if they've thought it all through before, then it can't happen. They do have magical thinking at all ages. And that makes them want to manipulate. So the example I always give, and I'm sorry if you've heard this before, is imagine if you've been hijacked. One night you came home and you were hijacked in your driveway. After that, you carry on driving, you're a little bit traumatized, but you now know that you're scared to stop. And every time you get to Red Robot, you do what we only do in Joburg. You, at night, you stop and you look both ways and you cross, right? Because Red Robots, at night, you don't keep them. Say there's a traffic cop just across from the Red Robot as I drive through it and he stops me and he says, you've broken the law, you just drove through a Red Robot. I believe I was going to get hijacked at that robot. So I don't say, I'm sorry, officer, please forgive me, I made a mistake. I say, what law? If you were doing your job, there wouldn't be hijackers at every place. I didn't break the law. You're not making the law. You're the problem, not me. You can't do. And I would get exceptionally aggressive and manipulative because anxious people make their own rules in the world. They decide what their rules will be to manage. So manipulative children get every possible way to sleep in parents' beds, to get out of doing homework, to get out of doing deadlines. They cry, they're sick, they every single test or deadline is an ordeal, and they start to learn how to manipulate to get their needs met. So manipulative doesn't mean malicious, but it means trying to get their needs met. So those would be the signs, I would say. And a lot of, just when I said about symptomatic, a lot of anxious children get very bad diarrhea and very bad nausea. And again, they end up going to a gastro, and we go through everything before we rule every single thing out and we realize it is anxiety.
And would you say that that manipulative behavior as well that you see is them trying to regain a sense of control of their world? Because
Yes. If you think you're not managing, you need to control.
Yeah.
Yes. Best analogy of anxiety, which I use all the time to for parents to understand, is if everyone's been anxious at a certain time. So think for a minute of a time when you were really anxious. Something you knew something bad would happen. Usually it's imaginary, but whether it was or wasn't. When children and teenagers are anxious, imagine it's like a hole over here. You've got this anxious hole that even us as adults can't handle. That's why adults self-medicate. We drink, we take tranquilizers, we smoke, we do something to get rid of that feeling. Children and teenagers hopefully can't access that all, let's just say. So they've got this terrible feeling and they have to try and get rid of it. So they learn from a young age, and this I'm talking about is genetic anxiety, children who are anxious. They can't sit with that feeling something bad is going to happen. So they learn that if they control their mom or their safest caregiver, they're going to feel better. So they then control mom, and what they say is, I'm not bathing now, I'm not eating supper, I'm not whatever, I'm only going to do it when daddy's home or when I decide or I'm not hungry or I hate snackages, I've eaten them for the last 3 weeks, but tonight I hate that and I'm never eating it again and you have to make me another supper. We as parents have limited energy and ability to cope with our child getting very, very fixated on something. So we usually give in. We give them a later bedtime. We let them sleep in our bed. We make them a different supper. And our kids feel great because that hole has closed for a few minutes until they've done or got what they wanted. And that then becomes a hole of, oh my God, I'm in control and I'm the adult in my home. So the hole gets bigger, so I get more controlling. And that's why if you want to find an anxious child, you say to the parents who's in control of your family, the anxious child is controlling everything because they've got so much more energy than us, and we don't realize we're making it worse. And that's why there are actually very specific parenting ways to get an anxious child to reverse that and close that hole.
Sure, that's a really fascinating way to have described that. So what other behaviors would you see in the parent of an anxious child?
The parents doubt themselves fully. They've been blamed from when their child was 3 years old that they're the problem. So then they know they are. The nursery school teacher, when the child wouldn't separate because the child was anxious, is saying, you're just such an anxious mommy. Shame. If you just weren't so anxious, the child would be fine. There's all the smug mums around. I hate smug mums just because I wish I could have been one, never managed. But those are the ones when your child has never slept and you feel like you actually want, you understand that shaker baby syndrome, you know, that kind of thing. And those smug mums are like, but you just put him down and he falls asleep. I don't understand. Why don't you just do that? And that goes on through life. You know, just the only thing is as your kids get older, you can't, it gets more, you can't share their embarrassments. But when they were little and you would say they're still wetting their bed and they would look at you like, or you would explain that they'd had a meltdown in a shopping center and you'd given in because everyone was looking at you and they would, well, my child just doesn't melt down. What are you doing wrong? So anxious parents, when I say smug mums, I hate smug mums, anxious parents all nod and know exactly what I'm talking about because they've been judged because their children are anxious. And you can be smug when you've got an in-the-box child, which is 60% of children. So those are the children who are just a pleasure to bring up. They do things right. They fit into mainstream school systems. You go to parents' evening and all you hear about is what great parents you are and what a great kid you are. And you just hope they don't know the next sibling who's coming up or that they won't judge you. The other things parents often have is guilt. There's something they know that child's got a slightly harder life or harder journey, even though it's never been put into words, and they overcompensate with that child. There's more sibling rivalry towards that child at home. The other siblings feel that child gets away with a lot more than the other kids are allowed to, and it's true, the parents will deny it, but the kid does usually. There's a softening where those parents just intuitively know this child needs a bit more support, but they don't always balance it well. They feel that this parenting is relentless and hard work. They're the kind of parents who, if they are honest, would say, if I'd known it would be this, I wouldn't have gone into it. It never stops. I can't go out without them phoning me. If I'm 5 minutes late, they phone me 4 times. You have no idea. You're all telling me that my child's great, because anxious children actually present very well in the world. But you have no idea the meltdown we had last night and that I spent 6 hours with this child getting her spelling right so she could get 10 out of 10 and smile sweetly at the teacher and act like that was normal. So we know anxious parents of anxious children also know that their child's first response will always be no, that their child is very rigid, their child is bossy and controlling, and the whole family often listens to that child and they've learned to work around that child. The final thing also is parents of anxious children are very scared to criticize their anxious child, whereas to another child you can say a normal comment, eat with a fork and knife, you cannot take the whole thing, there's other people at the table. This child You know, when they say there's a snowflake generation, the anxious child doesn't just flake when you criticize him. He melts into nothing. And you spend the next 20 minutes saying, I'm sorry, I told you to eat with a fork and knife. Really, I was just saying it would be good, but really, it's not the end of the world. You're still a good person. You're still fine. So you stop criticizing that child because the reaction is so big and that whole flaking effect. And when you get parents one-on-one of a child who's anxious, that's how they will describe their life. Behind closed doors, and everyone says to them, your child is amazing, their children are head girl or head boys and have such good manners out the house and speak so nicely to adults. And you actually see these parents like shell-shocked when you tell them that, because that's not how their child presents at home.
Before we go into the next into the tools, you know, how parents can build resilient children, I can't help wondering what the long term of this is, because that anxious child needs to function in the world one day. And if they have spent their formative years in a household that walks on eggshells around them, how do they manage the first time the boss says no?
They don't.
Because that's ultimately, you know, our job is to see, we're trying to produce human beings that can go into the world and be successful. That's our long-term goal, isn't it? Just like a parent, right? How do we get there? Maybe I'm jumping the gun with this question, but I can't help when I'm listening to all of this thinking, but where? How long is this road? Where does it go?
I think that's why anxious teenagers have such a hard time. Because up until that point, their parents have changed the rules around the child and given the child a world where they've changed the world around their child. By the way, parents on the spectrum, of children on the spectrum, also do that. But there's more of a need. With anxious children, they're so avoidant and so strong that parents have made sure to make their child's life as perfect as possible for as long as they can. They're groomed into social circles from when they're 2 or 3 years old. Mommy's made 6 best friends, and that child's got 6 best friends. Every party is made around that. In grade 1 and grade 2 and grade 3, the teacher's got a phone call. My child doesn't like doing the school concert. Please let her rather have a job to hold your hand while you make the class do it. And we listen, because these parents are so strong and so convincing that only when they get older, a lot of these children, their social difficulties, and I run this a lot in groups, children get to an age where they can choose their own friends. Children don't want to be friends with this child who thinks everyone can guess their emotions and moves around their emotions. And children start choosing other options, and these kids are stuck because they've never resolved their own difficulties. These are the children who phone their parents as things get hard from school, and the parents immediately react. They have very highly reactive parents because their parents have been trying so hard to keep them okay. And that's why you see these parents, in the beginning it's a bit of a fairy tale, they're controlling everything, but as they lose control, they get worse and worse. And those are actually the parents who by high school are so burnt out when you have parent talks, they're the ones who don't come. They actually sit there and they're like a bit like actually apathetic by this age, because they actually don't know how to help anymore. And then they keep rescuing and fixing. And I actually work with a lot of people who do lose their jobs because their boss doesn't like them and they can't handle that, or get married and a month later are in my office saying, I need to get divorced, this isn't working, she doesn't always do exactly what I want.
Sure.
You know, so
I'm getting anxious listening to this.
Remember, I only see anxious, that's my niche. Yeah. So it's not the whole world, it's
the
just
problem
what
is
I see.
We are seeing so much of it. We are seeing so much of it, and it seems to only be getting, I see you nodding your head, another teacher at the back of the room there, it just seems to be increasing. If it's 40%, 40% is a significant amount of people, right? How are we not seeing more information and more tools and more this is how you do it, so that these children can still have a chance at a successful life and not be getting divorced a month after the wedding?
I don't know an answer to that. The one thing is there's comorbidities. That 40% is not just anxious. They're anxious and ADD. They're anxious and have certain learning difficulties. They, so it's not that simple. And often anxiety is going to mask the real underlying issue. So the real thing is filtering out, you know, their moms who are protective of their children, but that's because they are autistic and they're going to have a sensory meltdown and they need to be protected, or an auditory difficulty. So what's so hard is, although we're saying 4 in 10 children are showing huge amounts of high anxiety, higher than functional anxiety. Anxiety is an okay emotion, actually. It gets us out of bed and gets us doing what we have to do. But anxiety is dysfunctional when it stops us from facing things that everyone else our age can face or handle or do. But the real hard thing is, how much is real? I don't think anyone, I haven't found those answers.
I think for me, you've hit the nail on the head when you said it's the comorbidities. There's often something else underlying.
Yes.
The anxiety is the manifestation of,
right.
There is a manifestation of what is going on underneath.
Right.
And that we need to be sensitive to the fact that it is a lot more nuanced.
Yes.
Than just one diagnosis.
Yes, I
and
wish
that's
it was. It's never that simple.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that kid's parents could be getting divorced or are having huge financial problems or are single parented or somebody's just died in their family. Or, you know, we're living in times that are so stressful. Just load shedding put a whole lot of kids over the edge of, you know, so there's so many environmental aspects at the same time that I don't think it's a clear, easy diagnosis to make.
I'd like to go into the parent response to all of this, the how parents can build resilience and assist with the anxious child and raising that anxious child. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about the social media influence in that space. But let's go first with what do you want to say to the parents who are dealing with anxious children? What do you generally say to them? What tools are you putting in their toolbox?
I start by, they come and meet me and they say, my child is anxious. We heard you can fix him. So when can we drop him off? That's generally how it starts. And then I say, definitely, but let's just discuss this a bit more. Does your child have a bedtime? Do they have to go to school? Whose responsibility is it that your child gets to school on time? Is it yours or is it the school's? Children of anxious parents are like, well, if the school wants my child to be here on time, they must punish my child and make him want to come, because they've lost control because of their anxiety. So once you start getting a picture, you see that often that's a teenager who chooses if he wants to do homework, chooses what time he goes to sleep, chooses what he watches and what he doesn't, chooses what time he wakes up in the morning to a certain amount and controls the family. So I then am very, very cruel, and I say to the parents, I really want to meet your kid, but we're just going to get a few things in place first, and as soon as you've got that in place, I'll meet your kid. And I do 4 or 5 sessions where we get parents to take control again, where there is a bedtime, where there's a supper time, where there's a bedtime routine, where there's a time in the house where everyone switches off phones and has to look at each other, and the fathers find that the hardest of everyone. The children don't mind it as much as the dads do, usually. And all the moms who all say they off their phones, and the dads are like, just check on her settings how much she used her phone, you know, so that kind of thing. What's interesting to me is not only are the children, but as adults, we're oblivious of how much we're on our own phones,
yeah,
at times when we could be with our children. So the first thing with parents is, unless you are going to be in control of your child, you're not going to be able to help him or her, and you've got to get control back. And parents will fight it. They will say, well, what am I supposed to do? Okay, fine. You want my child to go to school. What am I supposed to do if he won't go? You know, and they mean it. That they're not being silly. They have lost control of their child when their child was 4 or 5 years old and set the rules in the home. And it's a very hard thing to get back to consistent rules. You only have 4 or 5 rules. So my first advice to parents is, you create 3 to 5 rules in your home and you dial those rules. You say yes to everything else because your kids are going to beat you on everything else. But on these, if you've made a bedtime, that's the bedtime. If you've made a wake-up time, if you've made a meal time, if you've made a rule. And quite interestingly, once you've got to that point, parents stop being scared of their own children, because usually you're scared of a very anxious child. And already by then, our sons don't even meet the kids that originally were coming. Sometimes by then, the parents have already managed to shift things a lot. after that, the real anxiety, that's when I work with the children. And there's amazing skills and tools that are scientific and work. There's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is you make children aware of their thoughts and how it's influencing their behaviors and how to change it. And then there's DBT, which is the nuance that I wish the whole world could be exposed to. And what that is dialectical. It's doing the opposite of the behavior of what you think. And that's actually what I've started to teach parenting. DBT is an approach that was made for people actually originally with personality disorders who wanted people to be close to them, but the minute they got close to them, they would reject them or punish them or push them away. And it's become a whole way of regulating people who are very dysregulated and very anxious. One of the top tools that talks about is distress tolerance, and that's what you teach teenagers and parents. Distress tolerance is, we all know life is hard, and we particularly want to protect our anxious child from getting dysregulated. So we try and protect them. And we do that all the time. I'll have parents who will come to, who will still message me now and say, bad news, like a terrible tragedy that has affected the whole school. A teacher suddenly died, or a suicide, or a terrible thing. And they'll say, I don't want my child to know about what happened. Should I just keep him home for the next week so he never finds out that whatever happened? That's the opposite of distress tolerance. It's, I don't want my child to feel distress, so I'm going to protect him from anything distressful. And usually those parents can't handle distress either. So if we can't sit with that hole, that anxious hole, that sad hole, that times when we can't control life and terrible things happen, we are going to protect our children from it. And that's the beginning of the first skill parents need, is they need to sit with the uncomfortable feeling that they have to control their child, even if their child is scary. And they have to sit with the feeling that they cannot protect their child forever from world, from how hard adulting is, from how hard the world is. And they have to start seeing what happens as learning curves rather than protecting or shielding their child from it. The concept in grade two that the child's melting down about, there is a learning curve in making the child stand on a stage if everybody else is. So it's starting to help them see that when they make their child face certain situations, they can handle the terrible feelings of it, and so can their child. And when they stop being so scared of those feelings, you see an immediate shift.
Sure, that sounds like very tough work for a parent. It's tough work for you. It's tough work for the parent.
It's very, very hard. It's reversing your way of thinking. And our natural way of thinking of parenting, when we each held our baby and we had a picture of, you know, my child was going to be a famous ballerina, and then she grows up a bit and she's got no directionality, she's dyslexic and she can't tell her left from her right. But when I had that picture, I had such a clear vision of what my child would be, what kind of parent I would be. And all of us have pictures. None of us picture being a shouting, screaming parent, having meltdowns, worried that our child's harming themselves in the back room. And, you know, so we think we can intuitively parent our children. And 60% of children can be intuitively parented. Anxious children need the opposite of your intuition. That hole gets bigger, the more you give in, the more they get it, and you need to actually reverse the whole parenting, the whole cycle of intuitive parenting. You have to teach them to control themselves. You have to sit with distress. You have to be a strict routine parent, and the first thing parents will say is, oh, my mother was so strict with routine. I always promised I will never have a routine in my house.
Sure.
And you're saying, well, that would have worked if you had had children that weren't anxious. But you've got an anxious child, and you are going to have to do a routine if you want to get your child back out of that total overwhelm of anxiety. So parents have to learn to be routined, to have structures, to be consistent. And usually that's not how we wanted to parent. So the hardest thing for parents of anxious children is learning to reparent and rechange things and have to be the parent I didn't want to be. However, by the time when I see parents, usually I'll say to them at one point, you don't like your kid, do you? And they'll look terrible, like they want to like fall off of the chair, and they'll say, no, I do love them. I do love them. I would do anything for them, but I dread spending time with this child. She's so draining and so miserable and takes all my energy. And when a parent gets back, when they learn these techniques of parents strictly have routines, have expectations, make your child face what they have to. A few weeks later, they'll come and I'll say, you said something nice about her. You actually like her. You're not seeing her anymore as the ruin of your life or the person who's ruining your family or the secret resentment around this child who's controlling everyone. And we don't want to speak about those ugly feelings that we can have as parents when we don't always like our own children.
And the guilt that then associates with those feelings.
And the guilt and then the blame. And that makes some of parents' biggest fights are over. This is your fault. You spoiled her. You did this. You did that. It wasn't me. It's very hard to take responsibility for our own child's bad table manners. It's better to put it on someone else, as in a stupid example.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at some of your notes on how parents build resilience. And you said things like to normalize worries. How does a parent normalize the worries of the child?
This is actually...
Sorry to interrupt you. The child's living in that monster space. It's not real. Like you said earlier, it's not necessarily a real thing. So yes. How do you bring that into reality and normalize it?
So I learned through a lot of trial and error how to do this. Sorry to say trial for quite a few kids who are completely uncontained and sent home much worse, which I can only admit now that I'm past that, thank God. But in the beginning, and we all do this, is we think if we talk to our children about their worries, we're going to help them. So we start explaining it. What is your worry? There's a robber under my bed who's going to come out and who's going to murder me. Let's draw him. Let's think about him. Let's talk about him. What does he look like? How's he going to murder you? What kind of weapons do you have? Okay, that was a great session. It's just a worry. Goodbye. See you next week. And often as parents, we do that same thing. We start normalizing it. The child comes home and says, I've got no friends. No one has been friendly. I've got no friends in the whole class and everyone is horrible to me. And we start asking them questions and talking about it. Friends in particular get a lot of attention because we all want our child to have friends. And we start asking them and talking about it. And at the end, we're like, gee, you really have no friends, because that's where we get to. And we don't know why they have big reactions or they stop talking to us. The other thing that often children will tell me is I don't tell my parents my worries because they get so worried and they have such big reactions that it's actually easier for me not to. I'd rather handle it by myself. And those exact same children's parents say, there's not a thing I don't know about my child. We tell each other everything. Yeah. Me and my child, I swear there's not a thing he hasn't told me. And then the child will sit here and say, I don't tell my mother anything because her reactions are so big. So when I'm talking about normalizing worries, those are normal parent-teenager kind of dynamics.
Okay.
But the way we normalize worries is we don't make it bigger. We don't engage in it, but we understand and we help people understand what is a worry and how does that work. And what we normalize is we all get worries. It's normal to have a worry, but actually that's junk. Can we get on with our life? The way that actually OCD is handled, OCD is anxiety. By the way, when we talk about anxiety, anxiety is an umbrella term. Anxiety that is uncontained goes into a whole lot of different anxieties. There's certain phobias or social phobias or not being able to face certain things at all, won't go to a house where there's a dog. So there's phobias. There's OCD, which is obsessions and compulsions. There's not being able to sleep at all at night or be alone. There's a whole lot of different ones. Eventually, uncontained anxiety, which goes into there, the brain can't handle that much hysteria and panic and emotions. And then the brain almost drops down into depression. So depression is a result of a lot of anxiety that has flooded the brain. And that's why we have to deal with it in the right way. So what's quite interesting with OCD is when we get a thought in our head that we cannot get out of our head and it keeps coming in. So the way really the basics, I'm telling you obviously I'm simplifying it, but this is the theory of it, is you explain that we each have 200 to 300 thoughts a day that are junk within all our other thoughts. We are adults. We're not as bright and clever as our teenagers who have 400 to 600 thoughts a day. And we've all had them. If you've ever been driving and there was a beggar in the middle of the street and you drove past quite close and for a second you think, did I knock him over? You know, just for a second. Or somebody's sitting with their feet in the street and you think, did I drive over their feet? Or, you know, you're sitting in a meeting being very polite and everyone's saying very nice things to the parents. And in your head, you're like, I wish I could say what I really think. Can you imagine saying, oh, gee, we the problem. Should we start on you? You know, that kind of thing when they're ripping apart the school and telling us everything we've done wrong. We have a lot of crazy thoughts during the day, but we know to dismiss those thoughts. Anxiety is when we take a thought that we know is junk, our brain knows it's junk, but our heart's telling us it's true, and therefore we have to keep on pursuing it. OCD is a few steps further. We know that that thought is wrong, but we also know that if I don't double check a 17th time, if I haven't locked the front door, my house is going to burn down and it's going to be my fault. So we start to teach people with those thoughts from an anxiety level up to an obsessive or a compulsive level to understand that we all have junk thoughts. It's a junk thought. That's okay. We all have them. Now let's get on with our day. And funnily enough, that normalizing is the best thing. So I'm just having an example today. I had a mom who's just found out she's pregnant and she's like, I need medication. I can't do this. How's it going to feel? I'm going to get fat. It's going to be so sore. I'm never going to be a good parent. How am I going to know what to do with the baby? And I was like, this is normal. If you weren't worrying like this, I'd be much more worried because that's exactly how it's going to be. I didn't say that part. I was like, you know, it's going to be lovely. But that part of it is when we start to normalize, it's normal to come home from school and say, I don't think I've got any friends because you've had a bad day and you're feeling oversensitive and you're feeling alone. So you can say to your kid, that's a normal thought. What happened? Let's talk about it. So the first thing is normalizing that worries are not real. They are junk thoughts that keep coming into our head. And your job as you grow up is to learn to filter those thoughts. And you actually, at different levels, you explain it to kids. How do I know that this Nachi, I put the Nachi peel in the dustbin and not the Nachi? And they look at you like you're completely doff a lot of the time. But you explain, you learn the peel is rubbish and the fruit is what you can eat. How did you know that? You know, and that's what thoughts are. They are thoughts that we keep and they're thoughts that we don't. What's a hoarder? You know, those old people who die with 40,000 newspapers in their home and a lot of rats. They had a glitch in their brain that they thought newspaper was valuable. So their brain glitched. That's what anxiety is. Your brain is glitching. And rather than getting stuck on it, which is how I started off, is we rather reverse it to, okay, your brain's glitching. You had a worry. Now let's take it and move on with what are we going to do with that. So that's one of the strongest skills that parents can start to do. So that's why I say it's to normalize worries, and then you listen through it. You're feeling like you've got no friends. Why? Like, that's okay. That's a worry. Why? What happened? The other thing we do as parents is we try and fix right away. So we jump in. Okay, don't worry. I'll phone your teacher tomorrow and tell her to make sure someone plays with you at break. Okay, I'll do this or that. We all know also, just to tell you, so when a child worries, we normalize their worries are normal. We listen to their whole story to try to figure out what are they really saying? Why are they saying they've got no friends? What is really the stress? What is happening? We acknowledge what they're feeling. So with small children, you say you're feeling sad because no one played with you at break. Teenagers, you try and acknowledge their feeling. Remember, they're teenagers. They know everything. You know nothing. So you say to them, you're really angry that the teacher embarrassed you and it wasn't even you. I'm not angry. Okay, what are you? I'm frustrated. You're never going to guess a teenager's emotions right because you can't get anything right with them. But at least you're letting them learn that how to express what are they feeling. And once you can go to the feeling, you can already start to figure it out, take it away from anxiety and worries to what they couldn't express, to what are you going to do and what do we do with that feeling, that it's okay, feelings pass. The other good analogies for parents is feelings are like a storm. When you're in the middle of a storm, there's that cloud above you, you feel like it's not going to pass. But if you wait, it does pass over and you see the sun again. And we're also scared of our children being uncomfortable. We think we have to remove the feeling. But then we say, okay, we're sad. We're all feeling sad. You had a horrible day, and what happened was very sad. fine, we can feel sad, but let's go for a walk while we're feeling sad. And it's quite amazing when you allow children to feel, instead of trying to rescue them and take it away, they pass through those feelings very fast, and then they can get to the other side.
So I'm going to ask a question that's probably a bit of a rabbit hole and possibly a little uncomfortable. What does the parent do when they've employed these strategies, but the manipulative teenager is now starting to force the issue and escalate the issue and starts to weaponize the feelings in order to regain that sense of, to have that parent close that hole that you're talking about? So yes. If I don't get what I need to escalate the situation, so if you don't do this now, if you don't give me the different supper, if you don't allow me to change the bedtime or dictate how bedtime's going to look, or take my device, or whatever it may be, I'm going to.
Very good question. And the saddest part is what teenagers are starting to use to threaten parents is self-harm. And that's really scary.
Yes.
You said no to me, I don't like how you made me feel, so they'll come out of their bedroom with a cut on their body somewhere, and nothing is more scary for a parent.
Yeah.
So that is weaponizing. I mean, I don't know if you were going that
extreme. That's exactly where I'm going.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see more and more self-harming all the time, and it's very, very scary to deal with. In fact, the amount of sites that these kids show me that they have about how to self-harm, where looks worse, where doesn't, where hurts less, where doesn't, it's actually very, very scary, and most of us are oblivious of that. In theory, you want to give parents skills that they don't get to that point.
Yeah.
That's what you would like. And the way you do that is from much younger, parents are empowered that they are in control. They were made to be in control. You give all those analogies. You are the co-pilots, the mom and the dad. Often you see one of the mom is the pilot, the dad's the air hostess in the back, or there is no dad, he's fallen out the plane, or whatever it is. But you try and give that analogy saying that if you're not driving the plane, your children are meant to be passengers in the back and you are the ones driving. And if you're not driving, they're driving. And is that what you want? So you try and engage that. You try and get parents on the same page, which is what I mean by co-piloting. The biggest place where anxiety sits is where parents are on different pages. So mom is too kind because she feels bad for little Timmy. Dad thinks Timmy's never going to keep his first job, so he comes down and screams at Timmy. That makes mom feel more sorry for Timmy, so she buys him the Lego set he wants, which makes dad furious, and he takes all the toys on the floor and throws them in the dustbin, which makes mom feel even more bad and go get Timmy an ice cream, which makes dad start shouting and throw all the junk food away. And the bigger the split gets, it becomes good parent, bad parent, and the child's anxiety sits in the middle. So step proactive and best parenting is you empower parents to be on the same page as much as possible. I'm yet to ever see parents who are over here, just in case you're all feeling like failures. I would love to see this. I've never seen it exist. Well, I have like twice maybe. But most parents, if you're lucky with the right skills and the right values, you can get much, very closely aligned. If you really, with a lot of work and a lot of communication and learning how to parent together. That's step one. Step two is then parents learn how to speak to their children, how to tolerate distress, how to push, how to know that line, which none of us really know, but we fake, where you actually know what you're doing and where you don't. I don't know how many times you're like, oh, flip, I have no idea if I should be sending my kid to school or not, but I'm acting like I know what I'm doing and I'm sending him. But half of parenting is faking that you're the leader in the family and you know what you're doing and you're thinking, why are they looking at me? You know that feeling, that 5 o'clock time when there's little children in the house and you're like, where is their mother? Why did no one think about supper? You know, that kind of feeling. We all get that as parents. So we want to equip parents to take control, have routines, feel like they're in control, be able to enjoy their children and have limits. And then, interestingly, it shouldn't get to that weaponizing stage. Problem is, we're lucky if we've got those parents who've managed that. Majority of parents don't. But that's the first part of it, and helping parents understand. One other thing, just before I go to that, is with rationalizing, is parents need to know you never rationalize a worry. So when I try and tell you why you're being ridiculous, think of your worst fights you've had at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, especially if you're a woman and you're hormonal, and where you've said, I'm not going to get through tomorrow, I'm not going to manage, and that man is like, well, it's simple, just do this, this, and this, and doesn't know why you get so cross and go to sleep and don't talk to him, and if you're lucky, that's where it ends. Most fights don't. Late at night, when you're emotional, and somebody's saying to you, no, I can fix it, just do this, this, or this, it makes it a lot worse, and often that's what we do with our children. So when I'm talking about normalizing worries, I'm saying, don't be that parent who has to jump to the solution right away. I have no friends today. Okay, I'll make sure you have a friend tomorrow. I failed the test today. Okay, I'll phone the school and tell them the standard's too high anyway. And why are they giving marks? Or why isn't every child getting a medal? You came last for cross country. Well, I think that's better than best, and I'll make sure you get a trophy at assembly. That's what we're dealing with a lot of the time. So what we do here is don't do that jump. Stop. Normalize with the child. See what they are actually feeling. Don't do the rescue fix jump, and don't ever try rationalize. The other example of that is when a child says, there's a monster under my bed. So you say, let me show you there's no such thing as monsters. Get out of bed, lift up the whole bed, you pick it up, and the child says, he jumped into the cupboard. You can't fight that. So you don't. You normalize, this is a glitch, this is a worry. Now what are we going to do about it? Let's go to sleep. So sorry, I just forgot to say that part. Back to what we do with weaponizing, we need a lot of support and help then, because that's a very, very scary, dangerous place to be. And often as parents, we're almost ashamed to even admit we're at that stage. So it's one of the loneliest, worst stages to be as a parent. You can't really say to anyone, yeah, I've lost total control. The minute I tell my child to do this or that, he threatens to hurt himself. I don't know what to do. So, and that's when I do think at that point is when professional intervention is advised.
When you do engage in the professional intervention there, I'm just interested, it's a slight aside here, but I'm interested how you counsel on the social media element, because it's exactly what you just said. As soon as a child starts to fixate on a particular, let's call it a weapon, whether it's cutting or whatever it is, the amount of information out there on how to do this is terrifying. So how do you bring the social media counseling in at that stage? Because we know if the moment we say, well, I need to protect my child from everything that's out there, so I'm removing the devices, you're just going backwards. That's an impossible.
Right.
How do you navigate this?
I don't know. I did my thesis, a second thesis on, I called it Surfing Safely, and I created a high school curriculum for grades 7, 8, and 9, which we ran into 40 schools around South Africa, teaching children, technology is not our enemy. We are going to learn how to use technology safely. We're going to open up conversations with adults and children. I was smug as anything. My oldest child at that point was 7 or 8. I could control the world, and I thought I'd had a great answer. The program did run well. It still runs in all those schools, just to give myself a little bit of credit. Then my own children turned that age. My oldest kid's now 21, but I got teenage boys online, and I was like, I don't know how we control this anymore. I stopped doing Surfing Safely. I stopped giving advice on technology because I felt like such a hypocrite. I do believe the only thing we've got is our conversation and our relationship with our children. And we have to build such a good relationship that when they do see things that bother them online, that they're going to talk to us and not other people. Or when things happen, they're not going to search, how do I get rid of these feelings? They're going to rather talk to us. So I do believe the biggest work of parents of teenagers is creating a relationship with their children that is real and accessible and a high level of connection. But I wish I could give you answers. I struggle with that.
I think this is a problem that we're going to be navigating for a while with AI going in the direction it's going in, and we're going to sit with this problem for a while yet. And as you say, when we are living in a world where the kids almost need to dumb down to come to school, from a tech perspective, not quite sure what the answer there is yet either.
Yeah.
So what would you say to the parents? What should they not do in these situations? What are your don'ts for the parents?
My don't is don't rescue. Straight away, your gut is, my poor kid, I'm going to help you. I don't want you to be in distress. So first thing is stop rescuing. Stop trying to fix. Take a deep breath. I didn't speak about, but one of the best, can I detour around a bit? There's a Professor Daniel Siegel, who if any of you haven't heard of, is worth looking at. He's got a lot of YouTube videos, and his expertise is emotional regulation. He has a model called the hand model and flipping the lid. Have any of you heard of it? So can I explain it quickly? What he's explaining is, if you imagine this is the brain, because our brain is the size of our two fists, and you would look at it like this, there are three parts of our brains that are reactive, that react emotionally. There's our thumb, which is the trigger. Something happens that makes us react. And that reaction automatically flips our brain, and our brain separates into our feelings, which are here, and our thoughts, which are here. Similar to what I said before of our heart and our brain, and that actually separates. So an example is somebody is hijacked. I just want to use that as an example. The trigger is you see a gun pointed at you. You straight away go into the feelings part of your brain, which is survival, and you stop breathing. You do whatever you can to get out of that dangerous situation. You're not thinking, is that a Glock or what model is that? I wonder where he got it. You're not thinking anything. You're thinking survive, because your brain is separated. When that happens, adrenaline surges through into the brain because of that trigger, and that adrenaline takes 72 hours to drain again. So just to explain what PTSD is, because that comes in with anxiety, is every single time you think about that gun for that next 72 hours, a surge of adrenaline comes through. After 72 hours, the chemicals start to drain, and that's why we no longer debrief immediately when somebody's in a trauma or a tragedy right away. We know we work through the body in the beginning. We don't work through the brain for the first 72 hours. It's a total shift from how I was trained to how we work now. So what we do know, though, is that adrenaline starts to drain, and that goes back down to what we call wise brain. Wise brain is where you can think and feel and make a good decision with all parts of your brain together. And that's the ideal way to function. When you get flipped, people don't always go into only feelings. You've ever spoken to people who are totally logical, and actually you want to say, do you have emotions? Are there any emotions there? They can get stuck in their totally analytical thinking brains. They also are all actuaries or engineers or accountants. No, sorry, I'm just joking. They're not in education, the ones who get stuck in their thinking brain. But this now, every time you, after the hijacking, let's just say you've got back down to wise brain where you're making better life decisions, and you go to a robot where a beggar comes at your house, at your window, at the exact place where you see the gun. It's a month later, you get that exact trigger as if you're being hijacked. Your brain flips like that, and you're like, this person has been at the robot. I know his name. I give him lunch every day. I can't believe I got such a fright. What's wrong with me? But that surged another 72 hours worth of adrenaline into your brain, because your brain treats it the same. And that then has to go down. Just by the way, post-traumatic stress disorder is more than 6 months of adrenaline that just doesn't drain, because it keeps being re-traumatized all the time. That is that our brain reacts to these triggers as if it's a hijacking to any threat that we see. So an anxious child, when the teacher shouts, not at them because they're a very good child, but at the child next to them who is being very naughty, that trigger is the same as a hijacking for them. Their brain flips, they get scared, and they get that whole adrenaline surge, and they go into either their thoughts or their brain, and then they have to learn to get it down again. Months and months and months of anxious things happening, anxious thoughts, not being able to manage that anxiety, causes a chemical block here, and that's when children would need to get to a point where they actually need medication. We always try to avoid medication. We use play therapy. We do everything we can to give the skills, but there are times when those chemicals in the brain are so strong we can't get the brain down again. There are a few ways that we get brains down when it flips, And one of them is exercise. Exercise always gets the brain down again. Massages, that's why when somebody's been in a trauma, we work through their body. You know, in theory, the sea, swimming, Gold Reef City rides, any of those kind of things that are moving the body is actually very good, and very fast exercise gets it down. The other thing that gets it down is sleep, and that's a problem for people who are so upset or so anxious that they can't sleep because then they can't get it down. But the other thing that we know works for everyone is breathing, and we often don't, underestimate the power of teaching ourselves and our children to breathe. So when I work with anxious parents, one of the first things we do as part of bedtime routine is everyone has to breathe 5 breaths before they go to sleep. You can't use breathing in a crisis if you haven't practiced it before. So one of the things, and this is why I'm just getting back to the parenting of what to do and what not to do, is we start to teach our children, and if you Google it, there are so many good breathing ways. There's box breathing. You basically, you breathe in through your nose, hold it, and out through your mouth. That is also a proof that it helps to get brains down again. Now I'm trying to remember why I was telling you that.
The don'ts. We were talking about the don'ts.
Okay, sorry. One of the things that happens.
You said don't rescue.
Yes, is when our child shows distress, this is our child's brain, and they come and they flip, it automatically flips our brain. It is almost impossible for us as a parent who loves their child not to get flipped by their distress reaction. So often, our child is in distress. What they really need is a very calm brain to calm them down and get them down. But we don't realize that their distress activates our distress. And that's often when I'm in an intake and the dad will say, my wife acts like an 8-year-old with my daughter. They fight like they're both 8 years old. And the wife obviously gets upset. But what happens is the child saying, I'm not brushing my hair. And she gets a reaction to that. Girls bring this out in their moms more than boys do. Don't know why, but it just happens. And the mom and the child start fighting like they were the same age. I'm not doing my hair. Yes, you are. Then you this. No, I'm not this. I'm this. So often what we need to learn as parents, and this is one of the don'ts, is don't fix and overreact to our child's distress. And that's something you have to learn. So the first step you need to learn as parents is as your child flips your brain, you need to take 3 very deep breaths and get your brain back down again to wise, holistic functioning, and then you will deal with the situation a lot better. So the don't is don't fix, don't forget. You've got to be self-aware that you're dysregulating yourself. One of the signs of dysregulating is too much negotiating, and you will see that the parent and the child are negotiating with each other. You have to go to sleep now. No, I don't. I just have to do this. Fine. Then after that, you're going to. It's a whole negotiation is a sign that you've both flipped. Calm parenting is when you're in control and you're wise brain again. The other don't, sorry, so I just wanted to do that, but really the biggest tip I can give parents is use breathing, use exercise, be aware. There's nothing wrong with saying, I'm coming to deal with this in a minute, I just need the toilet, and going into the bathroom and closing the door and breathing 5 times so that you will come out and deal with it better. Because that first reaction that we have as our brain flips is usually the reaction you didn't want to come out of your mouth. Who remembers being 16 and promising themselves all the things they will never do that their parents do? I remember writing it down. And then when my kids flip me now, my mother comes out my mouth. It's the weirdest thing. I don't know where she comes from. I promised I would never say the things to them that she said to me. So that's a sign of a flipped brain. And that's when the first thing to parents is don't react from flipped and from tension. You're never going to react well. Moms shout a lot. Dads completely overreact. Right, no screens for the next month. I'm going to work. Mom, make sure there are no screens in the house for the next month. You know, dads completely overreact and dads lecture when they're in flipped brain. Moms shout and negotiate a lot. None of it goes down well or helps our children deal better with life. The other big thing, big step to tell parents is don't let your children avoid. Anxiety is about avoiding. So you say, you know what, there's this new craze, mental health days. I told my child they're allowed 3 mental health days a term. So today he's very stressed. There's 2 vocabulary tests and this or that. So I've told my kid, okay, you're entitled to a mental health day. You can have that. And I hear it all the time from parents in every community, from every place.
What does that do? I've got something I don't want to get to in school, so I'm going to avoid it and stay home with mom and dad's permission, never mind. But now I have the whole weekend to worry about that test that was on Friday. And Monday, I have to face everything I missed on Friday, plus the tests that I thought I was so clever to miss, plus whatever else I missed. And I've had the whole weekend build up. And that mountain, which in my mind was this big, is now this big. And that mountain gets bigger. So we think we're helping when we let our children avoid. We feel like the worst parents in the world, but you take them out of the car crying and you frog march them into school. School refusal is one of the biggest slippery slopes for parents when they're losing control. And that starts with these mental health or shame. Today's going to be hard. Just stay home and avoid it. The minute we let our children start avoiding external deadlines, we're on a slippery slope. The rule we always say is, I wish you didn't have to go to school, but we live in South Africa. The rule of the government is that you have to go to school. It's not my rule, it's the government's rule. So get in the car, we're going to school. And it actually works because it's a rule and children listen to rules. But the minute we start letting them avoid, everything gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time it gets to me or to some professional intervention, it's so much bigger than it ever had to be in the beginning.
I think where we've seen this from the school's perspective is particularly in exam sessions. If something has happened and a child has missed part of an exam session or a whole exam session, 9 times out of 10, there's going to be something that crops up in the very next exam session because they're moving into avoidant behavior.
Yes, and if mom and dad allow it and help them, shame, oh, you know, it is just too much. I just don't want my child to panic. You know what? They're going to come home and they'll be back. You know, we'll carry on next term. Often we can't fight that as a school.
No, we can't.
Yeah, and that just becomes bigger and bigger. So,
well, I'm so glad you said it because that's exactly what it is. That monster has just gotten way bigger and it's so much harder to contain at that point.
Yes.
Right. What else? So are there any other things on your don't list?
One is anxious parents get into a cycle where they give their children a lot more negative attention than positive attention. Negative attention is the minute I'm crying, I'm sad, I'm panicking, I'm worried. Mom and dad come sit with me and we talk about our worries and we get a lot of reassurance and promises. So it almost becomes the way I get mom's attention is by worrying without realizing. So the biggest thing for parents is be aware how much attention, there's almost certain triggers. You say in the car on the way home, mom, I'm being bullied. The car screeches to a halt. Mom turns around. There's words like, I don't have friends, I'm being bullied. Which you get so much attention from your parents. Parents have to learn, obviously we listen and we want to create a connection, but you need to catch your kids when they're doing good things and when they're just being kids and when things are good, and be aware that in our very busy lives, we're not only giving attention in crises, because then we teach our children to lurch from crisis to crisis because that's how they get attention.
And the kids are amazingly adept at knowing exactly which words will cause mom to bring their car to the screeching halt.
They know exactly those words. They know which words will help them. You stay in their bedroom late at night when they don't want to sleep. And they know it with their teachers also. Exactly what can get their teacher off a set work to...
Are you listening?
to ask a good question.
There was one that you had on your list here that I thought was very pertinent as well. Don't speak about your kids in front of your kids.
Yes, it's one of the things I see anxious parents do the most. Parents, anxious children generally do have anxious parents, although we don't want to label it. People who are anxious talk too much. They don't stop talking. They're actually, it's like a monotone in your ear. And you'll actually see that children will tell me, oh, my mom just doesn't stop talking. I tune her out long ago. You know, and mom will tell me, and we did such a good educational moment. I saw something on the road and we were telling the kids like, huh? Because people who are anxious talk too much. You all know parents meetings, that mom who you've got a 15-minute parent slot and she speaks for the first 15 minutes and then says, now can you tell me about your child? And you're like, they don't listen, they talk, because that's how they're controlling the world. And often parents of anxious children talk about their children in front of their children, literally in front. They'll drop them in the class and say to their teacher, she was a bit of a monster last night, hope you can manage her. You know, or they whisper, they point, they'll say, oh, Her behavior has been terrible. No one in our family. You should see how much her siblings don't like her right now. Yeah, and I don't think they realize what they're doing, but it creates a narrative and a story where everyone starts to fit into those roles. Also, it's the same as talking in front of your children about their anxiety, but it's not just in front where you're having an inappropriate adult conversation in front of the child. It's more that parents are so done and so drained and so tired by this anxious child that they actually start talking about them. And you will notice that more now as you see it. And it's a good tip to just be able to stop them and say, like, okay, you can tell me later, or you don't have to talk in front of them. Anxious parents take up a lot of space and a lot of energy for everyone else around them.
That's an interesting point. Do you think that also then extends to, it's a little, I suppose this is also a little bit of an aside, but does that extend to the parent who, for example, would talk about a teacher negatively in front of the child? Because, yes, you know, they are now managing their own anxiety and overwhelm and perhaps rescuing the child. The child used the big bullying word or whatever it is, and the parents now flipped.
Yes.
So they are now speaking. They are verbalizing all their own thoughts.
Right.
Not realizing how they are adding to the child's anxiety, because how on earth does that child then walk into that teacher's classroom the next day and afford any kind of credibility to the teacher?
Right, and the parents often aren't even aware that they've done it. So they have a massive rant about the teacher in front of the child. They phone the dad, they phone the friend, we can't trust the school, we don't know. And the next day they say, goodbye Mary, have a good day with Mrs. Whoever. Don't cry, just go into class.
And Mary's going, but how do I do that now?
There's some very specific needs that anxious parents have, of anxious children, need to know how to support the school, because when they don't, they undermine the school without realizing. But often they themselves are disempowered. So the same as that very anxious mom will always blame the dad, so it becomes bad dad and good mom, or the other way around, it becomes we the good parents, the school's the problem. And then you're giving that to your child. You can wake up whenever you want, but the school's going to be horrible and punish you if you come late, you know, because we don't have controls, they do. And then you send them into school saying, just make sure my child feels safe and loved and nurtured and cared and punished for coming late.
Yeah.
So we don't realize those mixed messages that we're giving.
Because I see here, you've even got a note on what schools need from parents. And you've said here, you are responsible to get your child to school on time because anxiety comes from being late. When they are now in that situation, when they're walking through the door late,
has to be at school 10 minutes before the bell rings.
Okay.
Have to, and they will start their whole day differently to that arriving late, hustling through. Everyone's already busy doing something. It sets their whole day wrong.
They spend the day playing catch up. Okay. Yes. So before we go into questions, because I'm sure there are some questions, are there any other final notes on what the school's needs from the parents or the take-home coping skills you want to address?
Finally, if I could, and I'm not here on behalf of the school at all, I'm just telling you what I see. There are a few things that parents have to know are non-negotiables if they want their child to have a good day at school. Their first is they have to be responsible to get their child to school with everything they need for the day, because the child suffers when they don't. No matter how much I say the school is ridiculous that they expect this or this. The other big thing is they need to make sure their child eats breakfast before school. What fascinates me that I find so often is children don't want to eat breakfast in the morning, so they don't eat breakfast and they come to school. And these days, I'm not sure about here, but most of the kids that I work with, there's a lot of use of medication and stimulants and different things. So you take your child who is needing anxiety medication or antidepressants or stimulants or Ritalin or something like that, and you give their medicine which is going to suppress their appetite. And then you realize that these children, most of the children who are the most difficult, who are no one can manage, I will say, does he have breakfast in the morning? And they don't. So that child hasn't eaten from the night before when they came down from the Ritalin, and they don't eat in the morning. And then you have this hangry child who's got no appetite, who doesn't want to eat. And they become exceptionally difficult, and that negative attention goes round and round. Even without medication use, that's when it's extreme, children who don't eat in the mornings, brains are not set to learn. And we can do whatever we want with children. If they are not well slept and well fed, they're not going to learn optimally in the morning. The irony is, as parents, we pay a fortune for medications and school fees and everything else that we're doing, but we don't make sure our child has enough sleep and enough food, which would actually benefit our child more than anything else. So if I could give two rules that parents have to have. As well as that, though, that's just two things that I find often parents are blaming the school for not being able to manage their kids' behavior, but their children are out of control because they are not managed well physically. The other thing is, we all want what's best for the child. So once you've chosen a school, parents need to work with that school. And if you don't trust the school and you really think that they are idiots and don't know what they're doing, put your child in a school that you trust. Because the minute your child picks up that you don't really trust the school and everything is a test, it's those parents who test the school final. I'm going to put him on Ritalin, but I want to see if the teacher notices. And then the teacher doesn't notice because she's too scared to say anything. She does or doesn't notice, but it becomes a whole test of the teacher's inadequacy, just as an example. Yeah. The other thing is sometimes the way parents... So trust the school and assume that the teachers are there because they actually want, they chose to go into teaching because they wanted to nurture and build your child. And the better relationship you have with the teacher and the more trust, the better your child's going to do. Sometimes I have these interactions where the parents have been so rude to the teacher, phoning and literally swearing and screaming and telling them how terrible they are. They haven't heard the full side of the story. They probably never will because they're so aggressive. And then they say, tomorrow Timmy is going to be back in class. Please make sure you treat him well. And on the teacher side, you want to say, you, the way you've just spoken to me, I don't want to treat your child nicely. You know, but we obviously we have to be professional, but it doesn't set. So the best thing parents can do is notice how they communicate. Teachers, it's jobs, that interesting thing of messaging teachers at 10 at night and then messaging them with question marks four more times and saying, you're blue ticking me, why aren't you responding? You know, or my best is, I've worked in schools for years, you phone to set up a meeting with parents and they say, I can't make that time, I work. And you're like, oh, because actually I'm at the school not as a job, but because I'm the parent. You know, like the respect of realizing the school is trying its best, the more of a partnership and the more we work together, the better. And there are responsibilities parents have to have. Trust the school, respect the school, don't speak badly about the school or the teachers. If this child has to do homework, whether you believe in homework or not, you don't live in Finland, which would be wonderful. So do the homework because that's what the school's expectation is. Those kind of things set your child up for success.
I'm hoping we have some questions from parents.
Before the parents have a go, I have a question. Okay. So many questions, but I'm going to keep it to one. I'm very curious in the spirit of building partnerships with parents and things like that. As educators, as leaders in school, how do we recognize the anxious parent? Often we're in, the frogs in the boiling water. We've seen this happen. At what point, how do we know from their behavior that this is time to sit down, have a conversation, and start talking about professional assistance? Because it's not just about the kid, it's about the parent and working together. Is it the parent who's running after you, the parent we're avoiding at all costs because we know we're always going to get hijacked, etc.? What is your experience in that space?
It's the parent that talks too much. They don't stop talking. They tell you what to do. They're experts on education because we all matriculated, so I know exactly what is expected in a school. And they are they're very sweet. In a very sweet way, they actually are telling you how to do your job. That's anxiety. I need to control my child and their world. They are sweet. They send you presents. They thank you for your time. They appreciate that they phoned you at 11 o'clock last night when they were very worried. But you see them and your heart drops a bit because you don't know why. They're such sweet, lovely parents. But when you stop, you realize they're not asking you advice. They're telling you what to do. Anxious parents tell you what to do. They're not saying, how can I help Timmy? They're saying, I need you to understand Timmy is anxious and this is what he needs. Does that?
100%. Thank you.
And they're doing that because they're trying to control their world.
Yes, and from sweet intention. And when you can confront, now you can confront them on it. They actually appreciate it if you have a relationship. Mm. If you don't have a relationship, you're done. Yeah, that's the Google ratings. Avoid the school at all costs because they told me that.
And that's why Google doesn't allow schools to be rated anymore.
That's a good thing. Not what I've seen.
Anybody else want to ask questions? There have to be questions, guys.
Hi, thank you very much. Enjoyed the talk so far. Can an anxious child grow up to be a non-anxious adult?
Yes. Ironically, yes. Always underlying, there's that anxiety that can come out. But they can learn to manage it and control it and contain it so that they're aware of it always, but they can really manage it. They will never be chilled, go with the, you know, let's book a holiday today and decide where we're going tomorrow. They will always plan their days the night before, have to-do lists. They've booked their December holiday in January. You know, they will always have certain ways of running their life. But definitely you can unlearn anxious thinking, and we're seeing more and more research about that.
Well, that's encouraging.
Thank you.
That's a relief.
Sort of funny, if you know of a book called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So Kids Will Talk, and they talk about when your child, especially the younger ones, where they don't have a large vocabulary, is to give their behavior a name. So that they can put a name to it and not think that there's a lot going on and that builds onto their how they think and overthink. And then it's calling out the emotion. Even if they're frustrated, but you say you look angry, it's still giving that you recognize how you're feeling. And from that, they feel acknowledged. And instead of saying, you're not doing this, you're not doing that, you seem to be confused or overwhelmed. And that in itself helps a lot.
Yes. That is the best book to read ever. The best book. I think every parent should read that book and every teacher. What's so amazing is we can often avoid anxiety by observing and just saying what we're seeing, because anxious people are in a flipped brain, so they're not fully aware of how they're coming across. So when we can say it, it looks like you're really angry and you're punching that pillow again and again, sometimes they don't realize. The same as that anxious mom who talks and talks and talks, doesn't realize what she's doing. So definitely that's the best way. The best therapeutic tool I ever learned in supervision was to say, I'm so confused. And make the person explain to you what they've just said. And when they have to break it down and explain it, you're like, I'm so confused. You're telling me you don't want your child to hit. Then he was naughty, so you hit him. I'm so confused how that's going to teach him not to hit. You just look stupid. And the person's like, yeah, because, and then they start explaining it, and then they're like, So one of the best things we can do in life is slow down and observe, and often that gives much more therapeutic realization than anything else. But brilliant book, and there's a teenage one and all of that, but that kids one is classic.
It's called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, How to Listen So Kids Will Talk by Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch.
Yeah, it's the basis of a lot of therapy interventions and courses. And that's why the teenagers, when any teenager parent says, my child tells me everything, they've got no secrets from me, I say, I need you to read a book. And I give them that teenage book.
There was a point you made right at the beginning that stuck with me. I've got a sister who's 11 years younger than me. I'm the ALO teacher at the school. So I'm forever engaging in very deep conversations that kids feel that they can't have with their parents. And one of the things that you said was talking about conversations that the kids aren't ready to have. Talking about death, talking about politics, things like that. And there's some that are obvious, right? The stuff about politics, for example, you don't have to be discussing something as deep as, you know, US politics and Trump. And, you know, use all these big things and scaring a kid. But how do you know how to navigate those conversations organically? Because there are times where you have to talk a little bit about the state of the world. Or when a kid says, you know, what's happening to grandma and, you know, she's lying in the hospital. We're living in a world where a lot of what we're being taught is talking to kids directly. Don't baby talk the kids. Don't avoid difficult conversations. A lot of stuff that's teaching us to turn our kids into little adults. But that obviously is part of what's leading to so much anxiety. How do we navigate that balance?
Sure, that's a good question. And your sister's lucky to have you if you're asking questions like that. My experience that I've learned, and again, I've learned by messing up plenty times when in therapy, when kids have asked me things and I've given them too much information, is I've started to learn that when a kid asks a very deep question, a political thing about death, about grandma, the first thing you always say to them is, what do you know? And that often helps you understand things. So just as an example, I had a 7-year-old recently who asked her parents, what is sex? So that's the two things that all parents jump at. The first time their child comes home and says, no, fuck, you know, and the parents are like, and they go crazy and they give them a whole talk and where did you hear it and this or that. And the child didn't know it was a swear word until they got that such a good reaction that now they know exactly what to say when they want a reaction. And the next one where parents mess up is on sex. Because, so this was a 7-year-old from a particularly sheltered by choice family who came home and said, Mom, what is sex? Mom thinks what to do. She doesn't know what to do. Of course, she's anxious, so she phones the therapist. She phones us. Believe it or not, I didn't answer the phone at that moment. So she says, I just want to explain sex is how you have babies and it's how a man. And she goes into all the things. The child's completely freaked out. I see the child the next day. And I say, she says, I didn't sleep the whole night. I say, why? He said, I kept thinking, did my mother and father do that? They can't. So I say, what did you ask? So he says,
oh,
I was in the bathroom and it says on the door, sex. And I asked my mother what that means. And she started telling me all these things about babies and penises. And sorry about my language. I talk like this all day. So it taught me one of the biggest lessons, but I often see that. We put our adult stuff onto children. They ask something about death. And all they want to know sometimes is, can I have granny's little tortoise, that's by the thing, that golden tortoise that I want if she dies. And some of the children really do say things like that. And we go into death, and is there another world, and what happens after death? And so half of the time, we are the problem. We put our stuff onto them. Other times, there are children, say a child who's got a brother who's 11 years older, who talks about things, she possibly is able to have much more mature conversations than other kids developmentally her age. But the way you assess that is whenever a child asks these questions, you first say, what do you know about death? What do you know about sex? What do you know about whatever they're asking? And generally, from what they know, you'll be able to see what their question really is. And then you monitor it to that. Does that answer it? But that's what I've seen has always helped.
I think that's a great tip. Check in with them first.
Yes.
And I think that it just leads me on to another point that Gersh and I have been we've been harping on about this one for a while now. I think the teachers are going to roll their eyes when I mention it. Using the right words in the right moment. Because another thing our teenagers these days are very good at is drama mongering through vocabulary. So I didn't get a scratch when I ran past that tree. I got an injury.
The
traffic was terrible on the way to school. I am traumatized by the Joburg traffic. Now, we know that we use words to speak our brains into believing what is real, right?
Right.
We tell our brains what our reality is. So if we keep telling our brains that we are experiencing a daily trauma in traffic, our body is going to start experiencing a trauma response, right?
You are, exactly.
Which highlights the value of using the right word to explain the right thing and to kind of talk them down off the ledge when they are falling into what I like to think of as the social media language. Because if it's not at this level, if it's not happening up there, it's not real and it's not worthy.
Yes. Yes, and remember that thing of anxiety hypes us into panic or hysteria, which does fall into the dungeon of depression and numb.
So the limbic hijack, right?
Yes. So we want to try to keep kids lower all the time, not allow them to escalate themselves.
And what we are seeing is so much of that escalation is through their word choice. So when we are talking in these conversations about big topics, I think we need to be quite aware of the vocabulary that we are using.
Yes.
And not engage in what they're hearing on CNN and TikTok and.
Yes.
Which is deliberately designed to sensationalize.
Exactly. I think that's a brilliant point.
Bayanda.
Hi, my name is Binder. I'm a student here, not a parent, not
Louder.
A teacher. Hi, my name is Binder. I'm not a parent or a teacher. I'm a student here. I wanted to ask, if you're a parent that grew up as an anxious child and you grow up to be an anxious adult and your kid starts growing up to be an anxious child, would you use the same tips that you've given everyone here?
Or yes, would you... that's a good question. Yes, but dabble. What's the rest of your question? Sorry.
Would you escalate it a bit? Would you escalate it to a higher level?
Yes. The first step would be have to make the parents aware that all of their reactions are on steroids or over dramatic and hysteria, because that's all they know. So I wouldn't even see the child in therapy. I would only work with the parent. And once the parent has managed to regulate themselves and learn that unanxious way of talking and living, generally by then I wouldn't even need to see the child, because they were actually teaching the child by example. So, those are the cases where I don't even get to the children. And the children naturally change, and you start getting feedback, oh, he's less anxious, and the parents will be like, I've done nothing, but they don't realize how much they were modeling to the child.
What about a child who is clearly displaying anxious behaviors and is in complete denial about being anxious? So... we have a child who definitely tells us nothing, so I can tell you right now, I know nothing about what's going on in my 15-year-old's brain. But his anxiety comes out physically, that he will vomit and get headaches. And I know that physically what he's feeling is real, that he feels sick, but I know he's not ill. I know it's anxiety. But we try and speak to him and say, I'm not saying you're not sick. I know you feel horrendous, but... you're not ill. This is anxiety. What could it be? You know, is it an exam? Is it something that's happened at school? What is it? And the answer is just like, no, I'm fine. I'm not anxious. Like, when you know better that there's something there, it's not illness. How do you deal with that?
You've got it rough, because that is teenagers. Sorry, not rough. There's a lot rougher. Just when teenagers in general are in denial about half of what's happening. So the hard part is when you can so clearly see something and they know that you're wrong and they right, which is being a teenager. Sorry to... So what I find is in those moments, you're too late to do anything. You can't parent or educate or change behavior in a meltdown or in an anxious moment. You can only work within that scenario and do damage control, and only work with it afterwards in a calm moment, a few hours, a few days, or a later time. So taking an analogy to a younger child, once the child's reached meltdown stage and they're on the floor writhing and screaming and kicking, you can't say, I want to understand your feelings. Could you tell me what's making you sad? Was it that your brother took you? You know, you're not going to get any answers out of that. Similar to the husband-wife fight at 11 at night when the wife is really tired and he's trying to fix everything, never going to go well. So what you do is you, at that moment, you do damage control. You get him to school to face what he has to school. You pretend you really think he's sick and you get him into bed, but you give him an injection or something that makes it not so much fun. Or you take his screens away so there's no rewarding behavior in him being at home and getting what he wants. Afterwards, you have a calm discussion and you say, I want to just speak about what happened this morning. None of us reacted very well, because I'm pretty sure when he's in that, you're not reacting that calmly and well, or I mean, I hope you are, I wouldn't be, or I'm not with my own kids. So the way you started is you take a bit of the responsibility. None of us reacted that well this morning when I was telling you you weren't sick and you were sure that you were sick, but I knew you had a science test at school and I thought this or that. Now that you're calm and it's all over, what do you think it was? And generally then, at first he's going to say, nothing, I'm fine. Boys grunt at that age. Do you say it's a boy? So you're going to get like a few grunts. But when you really get it to a point where you're taking him seriously, both of you are sitting with him and you start saying, Can we just go through when, from when you woke up, where did you feel it in your body? Where did that pain start? What do you think gave you that stomach ache? Remember, most of us feel anxiety in our stomachs or in our chests or behind our eyes when you ask people, or tingling, an antsy tingling feeling. So the gift of anxiety is it actually comes into your body before you realize it's in your brain. So I would start by teaching him those symptoms and signs. So when you got that stomach ache, what do you think now? Then it felt like a stomach ache. Now that you're thinking back, what do you think it was? Could it have had anything to do with the rugby match or the test or this or that? Or, and often you'll find when you start putting it into where's it in your body, how is it making you feel? We know it's real because anxiety gives you, makes you. I have kids who have done CBT because the minute they get anxious, they projectile vomit. Terrible when you have to do a speech in class and you stand up in front of the class and vomit. Yeah, and then they refuse to go back to school. And so it's a real thing. But when you explain it to him, anxiety is real. It feels like a sore stomach, but we need to understand what's under it, and you talk it through. You will slowly educate him to start feeling where it is. Whenever I'm working with anxiety, I stop the person who's telling me about the incident and I say, stop for a minute, picture it. Where did you feel it in your body? And you start teaching them to feel it and recognize it first. So I would go backwards, but I would never deal with it in that. In that moment, you're never going to get an anxious person to say, oh, it's not really a stomach ache, I'm just anxious. At that moment, it just feels like I'm dying from that stomach ache. Does that answer it? So you always, parenting moments are always after the incident, not in the incident.
How much of that, you know, you mentioned allowing him to stay in bed, but giving him an injection or taking away the devices.
I have a diabetic child. I have lots of injections.
You know, I understand the thinking behind that. You don't want to reward the behavior.
Yes.
How likely is that to happen, though? Because the mom's reaction, if she's been flipped, is to overprotect at that point.
Yes. So that's why you need that awareness. Because generally, at that point, everybody's actually reacting in a pattern. Mm. The child's anxious, then the mom overcompensates, then the dad gets really cross, then he storms out to work and leaves the mom feeling this. Or you can almost predict a pattern of where it's going to go, who blames who, what happens, what he ends up getting away with. So it has to be something that you actually think about it afterwards. Mm. Have you noticed lately every single morning is a nightmare because of this child and this is what's happening? Let's change the pattern. But you can never change a pattern in it.
Mm, yeah.
And that's when you need that awareness to think how you're going to change the pattern.
And you're not going to change the pattern if the pattern feels good.
Yes, which is the negative attention pattern.
Yes.
So I get mom and dad shouting and screaming and being really mean, but then they go to work and I'm left at home with my iPad. So I won.
Right. Okay.
So it was worth it.
Yeah. I got control. I'm having a great time. I got to avoid.
At 3 o'clock, I'm going to start getting really anxious because I missed the whole day of school and the test, and I'm going to have to face it tomorrow. But don't worry, when mom comes down home, I'll tell her that supper's terrible and she's ruining my life and I've got no friends and everything will go round again.
Right.
And it's not that conscious. I'm making it sound like it's a thought. It's not. It's just a pattern that when you take a step out of it, you begin to see a very clear pattern.
Sure.
Earlier on you mentioned that between the parents, when there's an issue and there's a reaction, the dads tend to be a bit more excessive. I think you mentioned like taking a device for a month. I usually will say about 6 months. So how do you find the balance?
Thank you for saying that. I thought you were going to say, no, we don't. But yes, dads have the harshest punishments and moms almost end up colluding. Just wait till dad's out the house and I'll give you your screen back. Just, you know, and that's the worst splitting that we can get to. The advice is you need to have consequences in advance in your head. There's certain things that we can control. So I have two systems that I like to put in place. The easy one is screens, because our kids will do anything for screens, and we can regulate their behavior with screens. Problem is, you have to learn how to have control of it. But it starts to be, you're going to regulate a specific behavior. So if they hit each other, the kids, you telling them, we're having a family meeting, we've been looking at the family right now, there's way too much shouting and hitting, and the way you talk to each other and tease each other is not okay. From now on, if I see any of you call names or swear or hit, you give specific things, because remember, teenagers see the gaps. Oh, I wasn't calling a name, I was this or that. So you specify it. You don't just say, be naughty. If you're naughty, I'm going to do this, because that means anything. You never say to a teenager, be respectful, because respectful to a teenager means I will give you what you want. Whereas respectful to us means a way of behaving. So when you say to a teenager, I want you to respect me, they say, but you don't respect me. Why should I respect you? And you say, what are you? No, you don't give me what I want. You're not respecting me. So there's certain words that you may need to make sure you understand. You then have a rule. If you do that, for 20 minutes, your phone will be taken away for 20 minutes. Or I will switch off the Wi-Fi for 20 minutes. Or whatever. But it's got to be a rule you can implement, and it's got to be consistent. And that way you don't overreact. What a lot of kids will tell me is, I'll say, what happens when you're misbehaved at home? They'll say, oh, my parents threaten and threaten and threaten. Nothing ever happens. And they smile while they say it, because they know dad says we're going to take this away for a month. Mom gives it to them an hour later. So that actually means our home is a casino. Behave however you want. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but keep trying. You know? So you have a consequence. So one is screens, but you need to make sure you're real. And the minute you're not consistent, you go back to square one, where the children go back to casino. It's called casino mentality in psychology. The other one is you can use a pocket money system, which also works. What that means is, let's say I can't get our kids to school on time. So we put a system into place with very concrete steps. If by 7:20 in the morning, you have had breakfast, you've brushed your teeth, your shoes are on and your school bag is on your bag, you're going to get 10 rand. If you're not ready at 7:20, you don't get the money. That way, when they start fighting at breakfast and everything goes everywhere, they refuse to eat breakfast, you've got a consequence. If you're not going in the car, you haven't eaten breakfast. But remember, if you're not ready on time, you're not getting your money. First week or two, that kid's like, I don't care. I don't want the money anyway. If you're lucky and you've got more than one child, when their sibling gets more money than them on payday, on Friday, it kills them. It's not the point of the money. It's the point that brother or sister got more than them. And that makes them take the system seriously. If you've only got one child, will you actually still do a payday? You have a family meeting and it goes once a week and you say, let's add up what you've earned. Okay, you could have earned 40 rand, you could have earned 100 rand, but you've ended up with 20 rand. Well done, there were two times that you were ready. And often they will put on that whole teenage, I don't care thing, but children do want approval and they do want to please their parents. When we are consistent and don't keep changing the goals, they actually like to do things right when they can. The problem is when we keep changing the goals. So what parents can't resist doing is, now you've got the money system, and then the money system is only to be in the car at 7:20, let's just say. But that afternoon, that night at supper, he's eating with his fingers and you say, that's it, buddy, I'm taking away 10 rand. You've just, the whole system's just shifted, the goals changed, the system, it becomes, I don't know if anyone's on Discovery, if you try to figure out vitality, becomes vitality. It's so complicated, you don't know what you're doing, so you just pay every month and don't do it anyway. So I don't know if anyone is doing that. But you know, so the system has to be so easy and so transparent that it works.
And how do you navigate the teenage negotiation? Yeah, but you said if I was ready by 7:20 and I've actually been ready by 7, so I think it should be doubled.
You say, you're controlling my system. That's an anxious child controlling my system. Right. I'm in charge. This is my money. This is my system. It goes by me.
And the minute they negotiate, you just don't negotiate. The big point is, the minute they start negotiating, you stop.
The minute they're negotiating, they're trying to take control from you. And you say that to them. You say, I'm the parent. This is my system. I don't understand what you're saying, but we're not even going there.
And I'm just thinking about the single child situation as well. What about using yourself as the other? Well, okay, you got 20 bucks this week, I get the 80. We're going to stop at McDonald's on the way home and I'm going to spend my $80.
That would hurt them. And remember that. So that would make it work. That's a brilliant idea. Brilliant. And remember also, though, the anxious parent is saying, okay, it was 7:25, but you meant well, yeah, and I woke you up a little bit later, mm-hmm. or you still get the money. Mm-hmm. The whole system's gone.
Yeah.
But when you have a system, you always start with one rule that you die on, where you just don't allow negotiating. Negotiating only happens when you allow it.
Right. Sure. So much to take Does away from this talk. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Lila, is that...
Yeah, so we only give... All of us give huge consequences when we're out of control and when we're feeling disempowered and we don't know what to do. And then we regret it afterwards.
We have taken up a lot of your time tonight and more than we scheduled. And I can't thank you enough. I certainly have a lot to be thinking about. I hope you do. I hope all of us do. So much value in the time we got from you tonight. And I cannot thank you enough for coming and sharing with us. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen.